Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, this is your host, Dana Cowan, and you're listening to Speaking Broadly, a show where I speak to incredible women about their careers and success. Today, I'm excited to introduce you to someone who has helped propel the careers of some of the country's most important and beloved chefs. Without her, you might not have heard all kinds of things about Tom Colicchio, April Bloomfield, Michael Simon, and many, many more. She's going to reveal the secrets to invisible PR. But first, a little bit about what I ate this week, because I ate really well. I had the most amazing bacon from Fatted Calf. Now, Fatted Calf is in San Francisco, and Heritage Foods distributes it. So I kind of went to the office and was given a care package that included wide-cut bacon, and I was very happy to receive it. When I cooked it up, it was like getting, you know, in Manhattan, there are like the skinny townhouses and double wides. This was like a double wide slab of bacon. And when you cooked it up, it was crispy and also really meaty. You know how sometimes like bacon just disappears in the pan and there's nothing left because it's all the fat. But this had crispy fat and lots of meat, and it was so incredibly good. So thank you, Heritage Foods. I also had the pleasure of going to Empillon in Midtown, which is Alex Dupac's brand new two-floor restaurant. It is big and brash, but it's also elegant and smart. And you can have a margarita and tacos, or you can have food that can surprise you, like something that looks like an avocado and yet turns out to be a parfait molded into the shape of an avocado that's been airbrushed. Very cool. And I have the originator of this great dish and many more on the line. Alex, are you there?
Hey, Dana. How are you?
I am fabulous. All of your dishes have stories, and I would love to hear the story behind the hash brown taco that you're serving at Empillon now.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're here in Midtown, and I wanted the new place to be a neighborhood joint. So I started looking around at what I think of as iconic dining experiences in Midtown, and one of them is undeniably the steakhouse, I think. So, to me, when I order a side at a steakhouse, I always get the hash browns, and I thought it would be really cool to have sort of things like thick-cut bacon and steak tacos and hash brown tacos on the menu, and that's really the original impetus for it. We make our hash browns a little bit more sort of fast food style. We kind of figured out how McDonald's does it and dialed in the technology.
No way. Tell me how.
Yeah, so the potatoes are cooked at low temp at like 70 degrees where they're still raw, but it kind of sets the starch. Huh. And then you can grate them and pack them into a mold and freeze them. And then you have these little patties that you can deep fry.
Wow. Well, they're crunchy and delicious, and you know, I'm not a taco aficionado, but I certainly love the notion of, you know, that kind of filling, along with the tomatillo ketchup. That ketchup is delicious.
Thank you so much. And, yeah, I'm a big fan of carbs on carbs. I know that people are very phobic about those things these days, but there's something so gratifying texturally about starchy crunch wrapped around with that soft tortilla wrapped around it.
Yeah, well, let's talk about more carbs that I love that you make, which are those fideos, which are, you know, they have that incredible creamy cheese and these fantastic mushrooms. And tell me about the fideos dish and what was the thought behind that?
Yeah, so, I mean, the fideos, it's a Mexican pasta dish, which has always fascinated me, that idea that pasta is it's actually consumed on the regular in Mexico. I think as Americans, we don't think about that. And it's sort of like risotto. The noodles are broken into small bits, and they're toasted, and then they're cooked slowly in a mushroom broth. And we get this really great aged cotija cheese directly from Michoacan. It's to me, it's Mexico's answer to Parmesan cheese, and it's a strong answer back. And we just load as much of it as the pasta will accept.
Well, then the dessert, of course, having had the amazing pastry background that you have, it doesn't surprise me that you've done something spectacular at Empion with dessert. And Instagram loves this avocado, and so did I when I ate it, which I think is always great. Sometimes something looks really good, and you taste it, and you're like, wow, that only looked good. But tell me about the origin of that great parfait with the lime ice.
Yeah, absolutely. Dessert is always going to be my favorite part of the menu. To me, it's the toy department of the restaurant. And with dessert, you really have the opportunity to play. When you think about it, if you order a piece of fish, you expect it to kind of be in its original state. Whereas in this case, we made a really great avocado parfait glacé, which I love just because I think most of us are not used to tasting avocado in a sweet context.
Right.
But we then use a mold, a silicone mold, and some airbrushing techniques to actually reform it and make it look mimetic of its original self. So it actually looks like a perfect half slice of an avocado with the pit removed.
I also love that even though it's airbrushed, usually you airbrush to get the bumps out, but you airbrush it and you still have the feeling of the outside skin of an avocado and it's bumpy. The airbrushing is sort of a dark color because that's the color of an avocado skin. So what did you airbrush that parfait with to make it dark and bumpy?
Yeah, the bumps come from the actual impression of the mold.
Right.
And the colors are just it just came with a lot of practice. It was just this proprietary blend of greens and blacks and browns to really get that peel to look as accurate as possible.
But I'm hoping that it wasn't, you're not airbrushing paint, right? It's vegetable dye.
No, it's vegetable dye. It's all natural.
That's good. Well, Alex,
it is a paint job of sorts, though.
I'm really excited to have Empion in Midtown now as an option for everything from margaritas to dessert. And congratulations on an extraordinary opening. And I'll be back soon.
Thank you so much, Dana. Can't wait to have you back.
Now I want to welcome today's guest, Becca Parrish, who is the founder of Becca PR. Becca is the practitioner of elegant PR. She believes that if her work is good, it will be totally invisible. Now, I really get that idea, that self-effacing notion, but I will tell you, when I was the editor of Food & Wine magazine and we knew that a chef we worked with had Becca as their PR, we were thrilled because from the editorial point of view, her team was not invisible at all. They were completely on top of it. They fulfilled our every wish and dream and made our jobs really easy. So,
so great to hear.
Thank you. Really invisible. It was more like invaluable.
Mm.
And I think that all comes from the top because you have such a strong point of view, Becca. So welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here.
Now, you have worked with great chefs, and each one of them, I'm sure, has, you know, their own story to tell, which is what you're so expert at doing. But can you give me an example of how invisible PR works by showcasing, like, one great chef that you've worked with and how you worked your magic on him or her?
There's so many stories, but I think that I would talk about Eric Repair from Le Bernardin, so who I've been lucky enough to work with for the last 12 years, which is shocking, actually. But but Eric, when he first, I had a tiny little office on 6th Avenue, and I swear it was an answering machine, because I remember I could hit the button and it would, you know, speak into the room. And I thought that someone was playing a joke, because it was like, this is, hello, you know, hello, this is Eric Repair, I like to talk to Becca, you know. And I was like, who's
cold called you?
Yes.
No way.
Well, he'd heard my name apparently from two people who didn't know each other. So we called and we met. And I remember him saying, you know, I've never been in timeout. Do you think you can get me in timeout? And for,
I love
for
it. I mean, and it just set the scene here. I mean, Eric Rippert is one of the greatest cooks in the entire
world. Certainly.
Well known for, you know, his fish cookery and his excellence. But I guess back then he was really at the high end. And so some place that was more democratic, like Time Out, hadn't
right.
apparently
how
about
could,
him.
How could he get in there? So I think the challenge was then, and it has changed, you know, through these 12 years, but was how do you continue and support that the esteem in which he's held, but then make him more accessible to a younger audience who is going to be essential for the long-term success of La Reina Den.
It's very smart of Eric to ask you that
yes.
question,
right.
you know, because he could have said, I want the New York Times and Wall Street Journal, and you'd be like, okay, but you're not helping your brand very much.
Right. So I think finding things that a Time Out theoretical audience would relate to. You know, we learned that Eric liked to cook out of a toaster oven for uh-huh. his son, which was legitimate. You know, anything that rings true. I mean, we're all about searching for stories that are genuine, obviously. But that was interesting. You know, even him. I mean, he's very fanatical about speakers.
Speakers?
Yes, like what he listens to.
Really?
Yeah. So I remember we did something in the Times on that, but. And even, you know, through the years, he's warmed talking about his spiritual side and
right.
his, you know, belief in Buddhism and his practice. But that was not something we talked about for many, many years. So,
and was that a conscious choice on
yes,
both of
to
your
keep
parts?
It private, yes. Mm-hmm.
And why was that? Did you feel like,
I mean,
did he feel the world wasn't ready for that?
For or? Him. But I do think that, you know, I think your priorities and what is meaningful to you naturally just changes as we get older. And I think it is almost become more of who he is.
That's fascinating.
As he's gotten older and, you know, you care more about how you're treating the fish and the lobster. You know, how do you kill it humanely? I mean, we never did that story, but it's true. And
I mean, you know that rings particularly true with me because Eric helped me learn to kill a lobster for my book, Mastering My Mistakes
That's
in the
right.
Kitchen.
That's
and
right.
he had me kill a lobster with a gigantic knife. And I was so intimidated. I thought he was going to I came to him and said, how do you kill a lobster? And I thought he was going to say, you either freeze it or you pat it on the head, both of which I'd heard, or you put it, you know, in the pot head first. And no, he wanted the most humane way to kill a lobster, which is with a gigantic kitchen knife. And I struggled. And I afterwards I said, Eric, you know, that was so hard. And he said, you know, your mind is not at the tip of the knife. I mean, it was so deep. He was basically
right.
saying, you're not concentrating. Like, the knife is stronger than the shell.
Right.
Anyway.
Right. Well, good. You did it.
I barely, with his help. But I felt I was hurting his Buddhist soul. He told me that I would come back as a lobster, considering how I killed that animal. But when you talk about invisible,
mm-hmm.
what does that mean to you?
I think that there is, I mean, I do believe that elegant PR, you don't really know where it's coming from, you don't know who's doing it, you just keep either reading or seeing or hearing your friends talk about this place or this person that you have to check out.
Uh-huh. And so I guess that leads to the notion that you haven't tried to make yourself a personality.
It's not at all.
Like, hey, you know, look at me and look at all the people I represent. You're
absolutely
you
not.
Just want them to.
Yes. The New York Observer does that. I don't know how it started a few years ago, but it does this list of 50. I mean, I'll do categories of, you know, niche PR and marketing, but the top 50 most powerful list. Suddenly we popped on it at like 24 or something. And it said, you know, Becca who?
Oh, wow.
So you may not have heard of her, but I was like, fantastic. I mean, that's exactly right, because I didn't do anything to get on that list. And I really do think it's not about me. Why would it be? And when I was starting my company, which is about 13 years ago, I wanted to name it Conduit, because I felt like I'm just, you know, a conduit between people doing cool things, interesting stories, and then those that can tell them. But my brother was like, oh, that sounds like a hardware store. Like, no way. So I opted for my name, which I you know, still have somewhat. As I said, I'm struggling now. I mean, I'm not as I'm very comfortable championing people that I believe in, and I really love to find great stories, but am less comfortable talking about myself.
And why do you think that is? Like, I think it's not. It's not just an issue with you. Mm-hmm. I talk to so many women who do not want to talk about themselves. What do you think
that is? I think that I'm curious about it. I think that women limit themselves by wanting to be good at everything. I mean, I certainly do that somewhat. And so you're only going to take on what you know matches your skill set. And I think men are far more comfortable having a little bit more bravado, more confidence and saying, yeah, we'll do it, and then figuring it out afterward. And you know, that's limiting, I think, to women in general. And so you know, my 8-year-old's here, and I hope she'll have a little bit more gusto, nerve, verve, and plenty of reserve.
I think she's had a great role model. Mm-hmm. So talking about the things that you know deeply and well, you have a degree in creative writing.
Yes.
And you graduated with a degree in journalism. Master's in journalism, sorry. And when I read that, I thought, well, of course you're doing what you're doing.
Right.
Is PR all storytelling? And how do you find the stories within people that you want to tell?
Right. About finding the stories, I think it is about asking great questions and being curious. And I think that, you know, if you are endlessly curious, it will always feed that need in you. And I had it on a personal level. I had it as a child. So I think that...
What was it like? Like, you know, do you have memories of just asking too many questions or...
Certainly. And part of it was I always wanted to know what is the most interesting, meaningful life you can carve out for yourself. And I wanted to find that out by asking people about their lives and the choices that they had made and anything that they regretted. And I was endlessly curious about having a child. And, you know, if there are amount of finite experiences that we know we can have as humans, like, to me, that is one of the greatest. And I'm thrilled that I had my daughter. So I think that I was almost using it for selfish aim, you know, too. Like, I really was curious about people, but wanted to help myself, you know, figure out where I was going to go in my life.
And then by asking people questions and then helping them tell their stories, it helped you figure out your own life along the way. Is
Definitely.
That what you're saying?
Yes.
That's a beautiful thought. Mm-hmm. It's become very difficult to break through the clutter because there's so much information out there. I mean, there's so many channels.
Yes.
People can control their own channels. How do you break through the clutter? How do you make it so that someone can be seen, you know, in 10 different places at once?
Sure. Well, you said the word point of view earlier. But I think that you have to have a clear point of view. You have to know who you are. It has to be real. And I, you know, partly started my company because I couldn't stand behind anyone that I didn't really believe in and that I didn't like, because we work really hard. My team and I work very hard. And if we don't like the person that we're working for, it's just not going to work out.
Yeah. So you interview your clients as much
absolutely.
As they interview you.
And, you know, you have to have that enthusiasm. You have to want you to work with them.
Right.
And so I think it does feel like at this stage, but always, I wouldn't want to take a dollar from someone unless I thought I was going to exceed their expectations. And I think...
But just technically, like, let's say... You know, is it that you're pitching more? Is it like what?
I mean, right now.
Yeah. How do you? Because I think everybody, in their own little way, participates in sort of
promotion.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure. No, I've always said anyone could have everyone. All of us could talk about ourselves to other people. You know, everyone could have a publicist if you wanted one.
And it could be you.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be the individual. So how do you actually? Is it you know, endless pitching? Is it? No.
The breadth of what we do has changed so much in a way that is very interesting to me personally as a visual person. The fact that brands can speak visually and that social media is incredibly exciting to me, and it always was. Like, we hired a social media person 8 years ago, and really have been pushing forward in that way. And I think that is part of the success of the company, is that we've evolved too. As our clients have grown, we've grown as well and grown with them. But I think the breadth of opportunities for a chef or a restaurateur or a hotelier, or, you know, it's so exciting because there's so many collaborations that are possible. So many people are interested and want to get in food. So the reputation, the traditional media, if you will, of that is part of building a reputation, that's a piece of it. But then the constant, the dynamic social media, that engagement, it's all so fast and so now, and it requires you to be nimble. And to me, it's exciting where you don't have to worry and plan. Let's plan for this year and this, you know, for this one tiny little product and then announcement. You can't do that anymore. You have to be constantly throwing up a lot of I would like to say something other than bullet darts, and seeing what sticks, you know, and seeing what's more meaningful. And then testing that stuff out, then you can help decide, like, what is the DNA of this restaurant or this person, and what's meaningful to you, what worked, what didn't work. And so it requires a lot more engagement.
But where are you testing it? You're saying you're putting things on Instagram, you're using Facebook Live.
Doing events, you know, and even newsletters. I mean, you know, it's all marketing now, right? I mean, the idea of, like, even not using the word PR, but I still, PR is public facing. It's still relevant. It is,
there,
you know,
are people
perception
who think
management.
There are people who say that PR just doesn't exist anymore.
Sure.
And you would dispute that.
Well, I would say that, I mean, my whole tagline when I started was, I was the anti-PR. Uh-huh. And my first interview at the Odeon, they ended the meeting saying, you know, we don't like publicists, but we like you. Well, I didn't like publicists either.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want my 8-year-old to go say, oh, I want to be a publicist when I grow up. Why on earth would I?
Uh-huh.
I fell into it because I was curious and good at telling stories, and I wanted desperately to live in New York City. But I think there isn't, I agree that it's marketing, but the how you relate to the public and what you're choosing to tell them and asking the questions to get to the root in a client relationship, what are you all about? What do you want? Where do you want to be in 5 years? What don't you want to do? And to really give them sort of a roadmap and a lens through which every opportunity that comes their way, every potential collaboration, every potential space, is it feeding? Is it answering those bigger picture goals that they have? Because it sort of simplifies things to say yes to and things to say no to.
So in that way, PR actually becomes a strategy arm of their business.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I always said, you know, we do thoughtful PR, the rarest kind, and that's one reason I want to get away from using PR, because there are a lot of bad publicists, without question. And
what do the bad publicists do?
Well, I just think they take whatever they can without maybe not caring enough or not knowing maybe this isn't a great story, and then they, you know, send bad pitches or press releases to people like in your former capacity. We'd get those kinds of things. I haven't sent a press release for 8 years. I mean, since Twitter came out, I don't go to an editor or a producer unless I think they're going to say yes. Otherwise, I'm not going to waste their time. And I have many friends who are like, you never pitch me. I never hear from you. Well, that's only because I didn't have something for you, you know? So I think it's being very selective and strategic. And I think there are people that just don't do that, you know?
I think that notion of only being there when you know someone will want something, there are probably people who have the exact opposite. Like, no, I'm going to beat down the door every single time. You never know when someone's going to say yes. But I think the strategy behind actually understanding what the media company, whatever the editor wants, is
right.
So important.
Oh, gosh.
That's a key. So between all of the things that a chef has in their own hands, or hospitality, whatever, which is social media, which one do you think drives the most business, actual business. You know, something like Instagram might be for image. Something for Twitter might be for butts and seats. Do you have a thought on that?
I do think that television continues to move the needle. I hate jargon speak, but move the needle more than anything.
Wow.
It just does. If you're selling a book, if you're doing some sort of special promotion, TV really does do it.
And why is that?
I think there are a lot of people watching television at home. And we're New Yorkers, and we're out and about, and rarely do. But I don't think that's the majority of people, and it's global, you know.
Right. And so you had always head for TV before you head for sort of the more fractured.
No, we do it all. Oh, no, you've got to have it all. Right. Yeah. No, I wouldn't choose one over the other. And, you know, and that's the inexact science and sort of the frustrating part about, and I don't mean to, I mean, I've always related more to the food industry than I have to being like a PR person, but there's lots of great PR too. And a great PR partner is incredibly valuable and incredibly powerful. But I do think that it's important to be under the radar and to, you know, feel like you're in-house. And in some ways, it's an underappreciated medium or role, which I'm totally comfortable with.
Yes, well, it's behind the scenes. One of the things that I like to do on this show is talk about jobs that people might not know about that mm-hmm. they might want to have. And if somebody wanted to sort of grow up to be a great PR person or marketer, where do they start and what skills do they need to be really great?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that because I have intentionally not hired, you know, traditional PR people or that studied communications in college, just because, you know, I think it's more important, A, to be smart and interesting and to have a life outside of work. Mm-hmm. Those people are appealing to me that add to my life, too.
Right.
And so I think that it's a joke now, but I have 25 employees and they're all women. But I think that ability to multitask, to consider, to be aware of deadlines, to be able to anticipate something before, you know, to be a little, not psychic, but, you know, just to be...
To think ahead.
Yeah, to think ahead. Thank you. And you know, that to have that sensibility of reading people, and if they're uncomfortable, being able to tell that, or if they're, you know, being able to draw people out, but also because there's so many different situations you're in, be it with a TV producer or, you know, something that's happening at an event. I mean, it is difficult to put it all in one package, but I think I reluctantly admitted, because I really wanted to be a newspaper reporter and was comfortable with that, with asking those questions and writing. I loved it. But I knew that I had other skills that weren't being used. Mm-hmm. And it really is this job that plays into all of them.
I'm fascinated that you have 25 employees
Me
and they're all, first of all, that's a lot of people. So congratulations on that. But also that they're all women.
Mm-hmm. I know. And it is
Have
the most
you ever
supportive.
Had...
I mean, I wish, let's call them now.
Yeah.
But it's the most supportive, fun loving, non competitive, which, you know, and some people may, I know I work for people that, you know, that was how they ran the office, was to encourage competitiveness in house. But I don't operate that way. But
have you
really
ever
is,
had any men in the office?
We've had a couple of interns.
And that's as far as they've gotten.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to hire a man. I truly would. But at this point, it would be strange. And I'm not strange. I don't know. The poor guy. He maybe couldn't be straight. I don't know. But
when I was at Food and Wine had, you know, lots and lots of women. And we had a few men. The editorial meetings would generally be like 7, 8, 9 women and Ray Isle. The wine
editor.
Who's
so lovely.
And Ray, I don't think Ray minded at all. I don't.
Oh, I'm sure. No, I'm sure. The right guy is going to saunter in. Maybe today. Maybe he'll hear us, Dana, and it's going to happen this week.
Someone's going to apply for a job at Becca PR,
Come, bring it on.
Yeah.
Ready.
You love the visuals. You have such a great sense of style. Do you train your team in the visuals, like to take pictures? Are they taking pictures now? Or they...
No, but I am very critical. I mean, they know the things that I'm a super supportive boss, and I think I'm really open, and I really care about those young women. But I am critical about the visuals. That's always the thing that, I mean, how things look, how we present themselves.
Uh-huh.
So that's one thing they know to sort of always run by me first.
And then do you train your clients in how to shoot and how to
I missed your question. I do think that we do a lot of that, and we're doing it more. We have a whole digital team now. And Jamie, who heads that up on my team, is really a superstar. And there's a way to give that kind of feedback because it is kind of personal. Yeah.
So I love the sound of that office. I'm going to take a moment to ask you about for a quote that inspires you.
Oh, sure. So this quote was on my grandmother's refrigerator in Brevard, North Carolina, forever. I just remember reading it as a child and never really talked to her about it, weirdly. But here it is. Some men, or women, never seem to grow old. Always active in thought, always ready to adopt new ideas, they are never chargeable with fogyism. Satisfied, yet ever dissatisfied. Settled, yet ever unsettled. They always enjoy the best of what is and are the first to find the best of what will be. And that is William Shakespeare.
Wow.
I know.
And why is that important to you?
I think that sort of endless curiosity for what's new, what's great, and what's cool, and my personal thirst for finding them. I mean, there is... Being discontent is fantastic professionally because you're always pushing.
That's beautiful.
Personally, it's not always as awesome. But I think that... But professionally, that it has, you know... fed the business. And interestingly, I had this memorized, I would quote it, but it had kind of, I'd forgotten about it. And it's so apropos to what, you know, what we've built, my team and I have built over these last 13 years. So
thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
And we are going to take a commercial break. When we come back, we're going to hear more from Becca about inspiration, and we're going to also hear about my impressive failure at making fondue and how I could have gotten it right with help from Daniel Gritzer. We'll be back.
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cookie machine. What better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
Welcome back to Speaking Broadly. This is your host, Dana Cowan, and this is my confessional. So I love having parties, and the other day I was inspired to have a fondue party. I was really ambitious. I went online and I bought four fondue pots from Amazon, electric ones, so because I knew that was going to be good because I could control the heat. And instead of doing, you know, fondue for four, I just dove right in and I did fondue for 16. And I used the recipe from my friend Daniel Gritzer. Daniel, are you there?
I'm here. Hi.
Hey, Daniel. Okay, so I read your recipe on Serious Eats, and you made it seem completely foolproof. And as we know, I have a tendency towards mistakes. So I thought you were really protecting me. I knew the right type of cheese because you said that it should be, I ended up with Gruyere and Emmentaler. And I, you know, knew about boiling the wine. I knew I wasn't going to burn the bottom. It was all really good. I felt I was in a very, very good place. But then I was standing there in my kitchen with these, I only did three at a time, with three pots going, doing it out of view of my guests, and I put in the wine, and it bubbled, and that was fantastic. And then I put in the cheese, and Daniel, the cheese broke. And it just, it wouldn't cohere. And I assumed it was me, because it always is, and so I had my friends step up, and they're using the beautiful wrist action, and it's kind of coming together, but it's really slow. And then a light bulb went off. And the most embarrassing thing is I actually had forgotten to toss the cheese with cornstarch. I think that's why it didn't hold. Is that why it didn't hold together?
I suspect. Yeah, that sounds like that was probably a contributing factor.
That sounds really bad, right? Okay, so the light bulb went off, and I tossed in a bunch of cornstarch, and I'm just like, okay, whatever. It can't be worse than this glop of cheese in the middle and the wine floating all around it. So what could I have done? So that's what I did. What do you think of that as a solution?
So did it work? Did it come together after you added the cornstarch?
Well, it came together a bit, but I will tell you, then it got really gluey. So I went from, you know, wet and sticky to kind of gluey. But in between, I did bring the, you know, the pots to the table, and we all ate fantastic gooey cheese on, you know, bread, potatoes, and other things. So what would you have done?
Well, I'm glad that it sounds like it got kind of mostly saved. And I also give you credit for going in whole hog.
Yeah, I know, it's bad.
There's no halfway.
No.
So my experience, fondue is kind of like any cheese sauce. And the trick with most cheese sauces is that as you melt, cheese itself is an emulsion. It's basically the cheese, the milk proteins, water, and fat held in a stable emulsion.
Okay.
When you add heat and you melt cheese, what happens is the proteins start to bond together tightly, and it pushes out, it breaks that careful balance that's been established in the cheese, and you end up with a grease slick and water and all the other problems that often happen with melting cheese. So when you make a cheese sauce, you're basically trying to add the heat but prevent the breaking of that emulsion at the same time.
Yeah, that's what's so hard, obviously.
Yeah, so whether it's mac and cheese or it's fondue or any other cheese sauce, you sort of are faced with the same problem. And there are a handful of tricks that you can use to help you out. So,
oh my God, I am so glad you were here to tell me this. Okay.
One of them is to add starch. So in the fondue recipe, it would be cornstarch. I like to toss the starch with the shredded cheese because it incorporates really easily and from the beginning that way.
Yeah.
I have seen some people claim that they melt the cheese first, kind of like you did, and then add the cornstarch, and they say it still works. So it's not impossible, and it seems like you were able to bring yours back together.
Yes.
Although my experience is also that once cheese breaks, bringing it back together is harder than keeping it together in the first place. So, yeah, I do like to put it in early. The other things you had going for you, you had wine, and wine has tartaric acid, and acid is another thing that can help prevent the cheese emulsion from breaking.
Okay, that's fascinating. Why is that?
What's that, sorry?
Why is that? Like, why does tartaric acid keep cheese?
Oh, why does it? Oh, yeah. Boy. You're testing the bounds of my chemistry knowledge.
Okay. But, well, let's just say that's great.
In some way, the acid can bond with or interact with the proteins, or maybe they're interacting with something, and it prevents the really tight bonding happening between the protein molecules.
Okay.
So it's sort of running interference with the thing that happens that causes the emulsion to break. Yeah, and then also more gentle heat. Like, one of the things when I was testing my fondue recipe that I found was that if I accidentally let the fondue get too hot, even with all these other tricks at play, it was basically forcing sort of the inevitable thing from happening, which is that it was going to break. So that is another aspect, is kind of gentle, slow heat while you're incorporating the cheese instead of a very vigorous.
Right. And what about, my friends tried really hard with their excellent wrist action, you know, stirring the cheese. Like, how important is the wrist in making this thing come together? Like, are we trying to incorporate air? Are we just trying to, like, what are we trying to do when we're moving the cheese around?
Oh, that's a really good question. Right. So when you're making an emulsion, or you're trying to preserve an emulsion that you already have, in the case of cheese, one of the things that's really helpful is mechanical agitation, because
oh my god, I should have just done it with an electric frother. That would have been better.
Yeah, I mean, you can even sometimes even like an immersion blender or something like that can in a pinch can really do like amazing work for you. Yeah, so any kind of, because it's the coalescing of the, say, the fat and the water and the protein molecules that are going to be your problem. So by moving very rapidly, you keep them dispersed and mixed together, which is essentially what the emulsion is in the first place. So
that is awesome. Okay, I'm gonna go at it again. You know, I feel like I've made one big mistake, and I tend not to make the same mistake twice, and I think now I have some ways around all kinds of challenges. So Daniel, thank you very much for joining me today. And I'm gonna let you know what happens.
I'll give you one more little tip.
Ooh,
a secret
bonus tip.
You can have
I need
in your
it.
Back pocket. If you order online from Amazon.com or another website, sodium citrate, it's a salt, kind of like table salt, which is sodium chloride. This is a secret, very powerful ingredient and emulsifying agent. And it's very similar to what they put in Velveeta and Kraft Singles and things like that. That pretty much guarantees that the emulsion won't break. So if all else fails, if you have that in your pantry and you just put a tiny pinch in, it can really save the day.
Okay.
Fairy dust.
Fairy dust, exactly. And clearly, I'm not averse to a little ordering online to get my party going. So thank you, Daniel, and I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, talk to you soon. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Becca, are you ready to have a fondue party?
I'm so ready. It's so funny, because I totally dig fondue and have a pot and never use it. So thank you.
You got to dust it off.
Yeah.
You know, buy some
cheese.
That stuff
sounds weird, but I'm into it. Sodium citrate. I wrote it down.
I know. I want to try that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything that will help me prevent the mistakes in the future, chemical or otherwise. I want to talk about where you find your news, because I think to be a great person to get people on air or get noticed, you have to absorb so much media. And I want you to be my filter. Like, if Becca was my filter and I only read what you read, the most important of it, and it made me informed, tell me, what would that be? Like, what's your media diet?
I mean, a couple things. I think BuzzFeed is hilarious and great, especially their coverage of food. So I think it's relevant because it's so topical and it's so now. Cherry Bomb, I mean, I love Carrie, and I think that she fuses food with politics in a fresh way, and she's obviously very stylish too, so it looks good and goes down easy. Amanda Kloot, her weekend.
I love Amanda's weekend review.
Yes, exactly. That's so good on Eater's, fabulous. And Ad Age, if they cover so much marketing, just in globally, that's interesting.
Adage has a really great newsletter where you can find out the most creative ads of the week, but also because marketing is sort of everything, it also can bring you deep into the news.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
the business of fashion and TechCrunch, I mean, both industries outside of what I do, but they're, I mean, they also have roundups, and business of fashion is daily, but the TechCrunch one comes on the weekend, and it's always relevant. You know, there's always something going on, and it could be food-related, but it's more just what's happening in the world. And then, frankly, we use Slack in our office and have for a couple of years, and we have all our different channels. And the random channel, which is just my team posting about anything from, you know, Beyonce news to weird food stuff around the world. And it's, I love it. I love to see, I mean, they're so dialed in. All of us are just dialed into the world. And it really is informative. Just that one internal channel from 24 thoughtful people, you know, out and about is really informative for me.
I think it's a brilliant idea to make your entire team your newsfeed.
Oh, God, yeah.
And you have, there's a way to make that happen.
Yeah.
So we here at Speaking Broadly, I always ask my guest to nominate someone to join the Hall of Deems.
Yes.
And so I'd like to ask you, who would you nominate to join the Food Hall of Deems?
Well, I'm going to nominate Maggie Lacoz from Le Bernardin, the co-owner of Le Bernardin. And I will say there, I work with a number of women who are partners of great chefs or restaurateurs, and they are really the backbone of the organization, but none of them get much credit for it. And it's not that the men would begrudge them at all. It's just the way it has worked out. So Maggie is not alone in that. But Maggie, I admire her and these other women, too, that kind of quiet competence where it doesn't need to be about her. She doesn't need the adoration. It's not about ego. But she sets her own rules, and certainly sets rules for her team too. And on the line, the last couple of pages are her sort of,
which is Eric Repair's book.
Oh yes,
online.
Yes.
And so, what does Maggie do behind the scenes? I see her. I give her kisses on both cheeks because
yes,
she's French, and she feels like such a strong presence.
Mm-hmm.
And it is in many ways, you know, it's her restaurant and Eric's restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
How is her personality shown through the business?
Well, I think that's what is kind of the magic of it is, I mean, to hold four stars as long as they have, and you know, that's a lot of years. I mean, 30-something. So to maintain that level of excellence requires a fierce commitment. And yet it also needs to not, you don't need to see any of that when you enter the restaurant. So, I mean, you know, she was wearing pantsuits, like, way before it was cool. Uh-huh. And she was kind of anti-skirt. And she wanted the beauty to be on the plate and to be the food. And nothing in the dining room should distract from that. And she also, you know, she taught me the art of this French goodbye, which I so have not mastered and never will because I'm not French. And she's just naturally cooler than me. But she would come by, I hosting some media person or something, and she would come, you know, the kiss on each cheek, and she just said, you know, be there, pleasant, you know, share a few pleasantries. And then I might be speaking mid-sentence. She just floats away. Like, just there it is. It's just, she's gone, you know, and it's poof. So her whole calm, cool, and effortless way that she is, which is so not a facade, but, you know, the real drive back there is so there, and getting it done on a daily basis, you don't see that at all. So that effortlessness, that quiet competence, I admire greatly.
And probably whatever she's doing on behind the scenes, mm-hmm, is quite intense and direct.
Oh, certainly. Oh, yeah, she's a taskmaster.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very opinionated.
Well, that is our show for today. Becca, I want to thank you so much for coming and joining me and sharing your wisdom.
Thank you for having me.
I want to thank my amazing engineer, David Tadashore. I want to thank our guests, Alina and Delilah. Without you, this show wouldn't have been as terrific as it was. And looking forward to hearing and seeing you all next week.
Thank you, Dana.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.